Today, the property market black hole. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the Property Imperative Weekly to the 20th of October 2018. Our digest of the latest finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. As you approach a black hole, gravity increases exponentially, to the point where it is impossible to escape. Recently, we've started to see signs that as credit is rationed, prices and sentiment are falling. And I suspect we have now reached the event horizon, where the only way is down. And this will ultimately suck in households, banks, the construction sector, and the broader economy. It is becoming increasingly hard to chart an escape route now. And very soon, we will be dragged in. So let's look at the latest data. And by the way, if you value the content we produce, please do consider joining our Patreon program, where you can support our ability to continue to make great content. Here is the link, and it's in the comments below. Last week, CoreLogic said that they were tracking 1,725 auctions across the combined capital cities, which was slightly lower than the previous week. But the final results are shocking. They reported a large 3.7% decline in the national auction clearance rate to 47%, with Sydney's auction clearance rate diving 6.9% to just 45.1%. And the weighted average clearance rate came in below 50% for the third consecutive week, with 47% of capital city homes selling. 1 year ago, 67.1% of capital city homes cleared auction. Melbourne's final auction clearance rate slowed further, and it went to 50.4%, surpassing the previous week as the lowest recorded since December 2012 at 50.6%. Clearance rates across the city are now down around 20% on last year, when the same week 1,223 homes were taken to auction and 73.2% cleared. In Sydney, the final clearance rate fell last week with 45.1% of the 647 homes taken to auction selling, down from the 46.1% over the week prior, when 611 auctions were held. And 1 year ago, a higher 928 Sydney homes were taken to auction, with 63.3% successful. There is also an increasingly large number of unreported auctions, meaning the real success rate is even lower. And I had the chance to watch half a dozen auctions south of Sydney this weekend, and none, not one, was sold. A real on-the-ground measure of how much trouble the housing market is in. And we discussed this on our live stream event last Tuesday. You can watch the replay on YouTube. And there are a bunch of reasons why the property market's fall is different this time around. It all centres on the availability of credit, and it's worth repeating the underlying drivers. Tighter lending standards with a focus on income and expenses, not HEM. Mortgage borrowing power dropped by up to 40%. Foreign buyers dropped 35% and significant hikes in extra fees and taxes. Self-managed superfund borrowing restricted. Interest-only borrowing restricted, around $120 billion for reset each year ahead. Investors less likely to transact as capital growth reverses. Tighter returns on rentals, half are underwater in cash flow terms. Higher interbank funding costs, rising mortgage costs and rates, plus risks from class actions and the Royal Commission. I could go on. None of this suggests a mild fall. And this is why we've updated our scenarios modelling, showing potential greater falls in value ahead. And we introduced a more severe scenario 5, which I discussed with economist John Adams in our video Scenario 5, Hell on Earth. Arguably, there is also a Scenario 6, which involves hyperinflation, but I have not found a way to model this in our core market model as yet. But prices, we think, are on their way down. And CoreLogic's weekly price indices also reinforce the falls. Since the start of the year, Melbourne is sliding more than Sydney, further evidence that the Victorian property market is in trouble. But reflect on this. The Perth market has dropped by 13.6% since its peak. And I discussed the dynamics of the Western Australian markets with Tony Lacantro from Alto Capital. And you can watch this video, Dispatches from the Investment Manager's Frontline. And here is another data point. It's the falling number of homes selling. Research by CoreLogic analyst Jade Harling shows that the number of properties selling within a given year account for a very small proportion of the total market, with the average trend even lower over recent years. Over the 12 months to July 2018, 4.6% of national dwellings transacted, down from 5.3% a year ago. The more pronounced decline in turnover rates over the year to July is hardly a surprise given current market conditions, with dwelling values softening each month now for the past 12 months, coupled with the lowest levels of new stock being added to the market seen since 2012 over the past 6 months, as confidence wanes and homes take longer to sell. However, the long-term trend can be attributed to a variety of factors and will differ between each of the regions. But based on the findings, it's likely that housing affordability has delivered a large impact on the broader downward trend in turnover rates. And where the likes of Sydney and Melbourne would have weighed heavily, given the high growth seen across these larger markets relative to only mild growth in household incomes. 15 years ago, the dwelling price to income ratio as a national figure showed that dwelling prices were 5.1 times as high as the gross household income. While recent data shows this has increased to 6.8, but in Sydney and Melbourne, where affordability has been a challenge for prospective buyers for some time, the price-to-income ratio sits at 9.1 and 8.1 respectively. In turn, what can be seen as housing has become less affordable across some capital city markets. Regional areas have benefited from the flow-on effect of being the more affordable option. And in addition, the high transaction costs to both purchase and sell property has likely added a further barrier to housing market participation. From the sell side, there are marketing costs, agents' fees and commissions, legal costs, and potentially some costs associated with getting the property ready to present to market. From the buy side, stamp duty costs a percentage of the purchase price are a major barrier to entry, especially in the more expensive markets, as well as the costs associated with building and pest inspections and conveyancing. More recently, CoreLogic conclude credit rationing has provided an additional dampening effect on housing affordability. So now, to economic news. The headline employment figure of 5% released by the ABS this week may seem to be good news, although the more dependable trend remains at 5.2%. But this was mainly thanks to more people not seeking employment. Damien Boy at Credit Suisse said that results were mixed and they did not move the needle for the RBA. He said that the September labour market report was mixed. Headline employment came in below expectations, rising by only 5.6 thousand in September. However, the composition of jobs growth was actually quite favourable, with full-time employment rising by more than 20,000 over the month, while part-time employment fell by 14,700 over the month. Aggregate hours worked rose by 0.4% in September, but partly because of unfavourable comparables, year-end growth slowed to 1.9% from 2.1%. And by state, hours worked fell by 0.7% in New South Wales, but rose solidly in the other regions. The biggest surprise from the release was the sharp fall in the unemployment rate to 5% from 5.3%. The unemployment rate is now at its lowest level since June 2011. The decline in the unemployment rate was not so much due to job creation, but rather a sharp fall in the labour force participation rate to 65.4% from 65.7%. And he went on to say that RBA Deputy Governor De Bell argued that labour market conditions are strong, but notwithstanding the bank's expectation for continued solid job creation, it is quite likely that the unemployment rate can fall further before wage inflation comes back in earnest. The September labour market data fits into this story. Job creation has continued at a solid pace, but it is hard to read too much into the apparent erosion of labour market slack because, first, unemployment rates have reached very low levels in developed economies, but yet there is not compelling evidence that wage inflation is breaking out. The international experience suggests that it may take a while for inflation to pick up, even after full employment is reached. And second, there are technical factors at work suppressing the official unemployment rate. For what it's worth, Bowie says that their proprietary measure of slack in the economy based on the NAB survey capacity utilization and male full-time equivalent employment as a share of the active labour force suggests that not much has changed over the past few months. The output gap is more or less at the same level as it was in the second quarter. And moreover, they note that the state of the labour market may not be the dominant consideration in RBA policy setting at the moment. In the Q&A time, De Bell suggested that bank officials were paying very close attention to what is happening in the housing market. Now, more are calling lower home prices ahead. The latest was AMP's chief economist Shane Oliver, who revised up the expected falls. Only last August had he said he expected price falls in Sydney and Melbourne to max out at around 15% from peak to trough. But he's upped this now to 20%, thanks to tighter credit conditions, supply rises, and a negative feedback loop from falling prices. Plus, auction clearance rates in recent weeks have been running around levels roughly consistent with a 7 to 8% price decline per annum. We discussed this scenario in our post, Does Negative Equity Loom? We estimated that based on his data, close to 600,000 households will fall into negative equity. And Macquarie suggests that homeowners with negative equity might claim the bank broke their responsibility lending obligations and could be up for as much as $6 billion in legal costs and remediation. We think that could be a conservative estimate. And later, we will disclose which postcode has the highest level of negative equity across the country. So keep watching. Others are calling for the RBA to reduce rates. The Cook is one of the latest, suggesting in a recent piece that the RBA could cut the official cash rate to 0.5%. And on the back of that, the employment rate would drop to 4.75% on a sustained basis. Underlying inflation would hit the midpoint of 2 to 3%, and annual wages growth would lift to 3.25%. This is what a range of credible economic models suggest would happen, he says, with such a simple and transparent monetary policy move from the RBA. And what's more, it would be free to implement. It would be, on all measures, a good economic outcome. So why is the RBA not going to do it? What kind of monetarist apologise, he asked, has possessed them? It is now a bad idea to try and hit their inflation target, put tens of thousands more Australians into work, and stoke a much-needed rise in wage growth. Why is the RBA the only central bank in the world, he says, seemingly obsessed with peripheral issues where the inflation target has been missed so comprehensively for so long? He suggests protests about house prices and household debt cloud the debate. And he says, these refrains highlight the other critical error of the RBA, its reluctance to embrace macroprudential policies to address these specific issues when they were needed several years ago. These problems, to the extent house prices and household debt are problems, he says, could be easily addressed with policies other than interest rates. Well, my view is that the debt bomb is the most critical issue to manage, and cutting rates will do very little other than remove options from the RBA later. So I think they will stick for some time to come. The kook does not seem to read the debt bomb the same way as I do. Pity he won't debate it with me. But the stakes are getting higher. For example, recent comments from the Lafferty 500, which is a comparative study of 500 banks globally, put three of the four Australian banks in the substandard category, and CBA came out a little better with an average score. Lafferty's conclusion was that all of the four majors preferred to talk about some other version of their results rather than the statutory figures that they reported in their audited financials, and none meet our target of 10% equity to assets or 4% cash to assets, said Lafferty. Among the other damning conclusions that Lafferty drew were that the strategy statements of all four majors are fluff and fail to set out credible actions. Failure to explain clearly to their shareholders what they were doing had led to the ratings of zero for culture and zero for digital dependency. This analysis fed into a list of 19 separate metrics. Westpac only scored 4 out of 19 metrics, with 15 no scores. ANZ 6 positive scores out of 19 metrics, with 13 no scores. NAB 6 out of 19 metrics, with 6 no scores. And CBA positive scores on 10 out of the 19 metrics, with 9 no scores. Now, this all underscores the repair job the banks need to do, including, in our view, structural and regulatory change. As I discuss with Robbie Barwick this week in our video, what does Glass-Steagall really mean? Yet we know that the Reserve Bank of Australia and the Treasury have privately cautioned the Morrison government that any regulatory response to the Financial Services Royal Commission must be careful to avoid putting the brakes on lending to home buyers and businesses. And others again are calling for a dial back of the recent tightening. This week, Robert Gobbidston wrote, "It's true that Australia needed a correction in the housing market, and the banks, which were key drivers of the boom, needed to return to proper lending practices." Bank analyst Brett Lemusier from Shaw & Partners says the confessions of the banks will cost the industry an incredible $7.4 billion. If the payouts are anything like that figure, the big four banks will be badly damaged and their credit rating will be dumped. To that, you can add housing bad debts. The underlying problem is all the above groups are busily doing what they believe is right, but the end result is that our banking system is being drained of capital, the executives are scared, and the end result is a severe credit squeeze that looks like intensifying. So he concludes, unless all the above regulators, including the Royal Commission, start stepping back and looking at the combined effect of what they're doing, we will see the building industry plus other areas of employment badly damaged, and that damage will last for years. But the point is, we are now normalizing lending standards to more logical and sustainable levels. You do not solve a credit property boom by allowing it to continue forever. We had better get used to the new situation, and yes, bank profitability will be impacted long term, back to more normal levels. And yes, construction will take a hit. Time for the RBA to take a new stance. Less credit and tighter standards is the new normal. So to the markets. Locally, the banks recovered a little towards the end of the week, with CBA ending up 1.04% to 67.90. ANZ up 0.62% to 26.04, and Westpac up 0.6% to 26.85, while NAB fell 0.27% to end at 25.67, perhaps because of the profit warning issued this week that additional costs of $340 million after tax will be taken in connection with its customer remediation program. This will reduce second half 18 cash earnings by an estimated $261 million and earnings from discontinued operations by an additional estimated $53 million. Now, all of the CEOs of the major banks have now admitted to Parliament that they did wrong and should not have resisted the Banking Royal Commission. But talk is cheap, and we need to see real change. The smaller banks also did a little better, with the Bank of Queensland up 0.85% to 10.65, and Bendigo was up 0.68% to 10.34, although Suncorp fell 0.42% to 14.07. Macquarie was up 0.51% to 116.87, still well off its recent highs, and AMP was up 2.21% to 3.24. The financial index overall was up 0.43% to 5,810, while the ASX 100 fell 0.04% to 4,885 on Friday after another volatile week. This was reflected in the local VIX, or fear index, which was up 1.29% to 1645 on Friday. And the Aussie ended up 0.27% to 7118, still in the lower end of its recent trading ranges. The Aussie Bitcoin was down 0.35% to 8,840. And so to the US markets, which also had a volatile week. US stocks experienced their worst sell-off since last week on Thursday, as they ricocheted back and forth on the US-China trade spat, compounded by a Fed bent on tightening rates, along with an added bonus in the form of the Italian debt crisis. And as if investors didn't already have enough to worry about, earnings shortcomings from industrial companies and Bank of America's move to downgrade the housing sector brought already fraught nerves to the breaking point. But on Friday, the S&P 500 closed just below flatline at 2,768 as upbeat earnings from corporates helped ease investor jitters about global growth. And the US VIX index was down just a little, 0.85%, to 1989 on Friday, but it's still elevated. The S&P 100 was up 0.26% to 1,236 on Friday, while the Dow was up 0.26% to 25,444. But the NASDAQ was down 0.48% to 7,449, with some of the big technology stocks being sold off. The three-month US bond rate was flat at 2.309, but the 10-year bond continues to climb into higher territory following the release of the Fed minutes this week, which underscored higher US rates ahead as they continue their normalization strategy. Expect more hikes ahead. And US mortgage rates also continued higher. Oil was lower across the week, ending up a tad on Friday to $69.37. Gold was flat at $1,230, having moved up a little during the week in reaction to the increasing market risks. And Bitcoin ended down 1.3% on Friday to $6,539 and continues in the doldrums, but there may be signs of that changing. Certainly, the volume of the Bitcoin futures trading at the CME Group has increased by 41% in the third quarter, and the community may be expecting an increase of the negative dynamics before the next expiration of futures, but this was smaller than the crypto community initially thought, and a number of factors indicate the preparation for a second wave of Wall Street invasion on the cryptocurrency market. For example, the world's largest holding company, Fidelity Investments, with $7.3 trillion of assets under management, announced the launch of custodian crypto services within a separate company, Fidelity Digital Asset Services. Goldman and other investment banks have similar plans. The intentions of such giants are difficult to overestimate. In conjunction with the race of the largest crypto exchanges to obtain regulatory approval through the introduction of tools such as Know Your Transaction to track user transactions, it can be assumed that in the near future, crypto assets can attract substantially bigger institutional liquidity compared to the grey retail investments in 2017. However, the strategy of large capital is unknown to anyone, and usually everything happens against the expectation of the masses. Therefore, we should remain cautious. The spread between borrowing costs for 10 years in Italy and Germany widened to the most since 2013 on Thursday, as Italian yields rose 14 basis points. The move came after the EU delivered a letter to the Italian officials that draws a line in the sand on the budget. It said the budget had a significant deviation from the rules and was unprecedented, calling it serious non-compliance. They said planned spending next year increased 2.7%, while the maximum allowed under EU rules is 0.1%. The ball now is in Rome's court. But first, Italy's two coalition parties have to resolve an internal spat with regard to tax sweeteners to the wealthy initiated by the Northern League. The risks are high no matter which side backs down. If the EU chooses to dig in and wins the battle, it may further alienate and inspire voters outside the mainstream and lead to significant anti-EU sentiment at a sensitive time. And if Italy's government wins, which is what most expect, then it will further undermine EU rules. Next Friday, ratings agencies are also scheduled for an update on Italy. That will be a major risk event. The market increasingly thinks it's inevitable, with the risk of a two-notch downgrade to junk. And finally, in case you are asking, the postcode across Australia with the expected highest proportion of households in negative equity, according to our latest analysis, is Victorian postcode 3030, which includes Derrimut, Pointcock and Werribee. It happens to be one of the postcodes with some of the highest levels of mortgage stress, and stress and negative equity are related. But did you also know that there is a clause in most mortgage contracts which essentially allows a bank to make a margin call in the event of negative equity? You may consider this, I guess, a futures contract on housing, but at very least it's another issue to consider. At some point, some households may be asked to make a capital reduction. Now that would be very inconvenient. And by the way, if you value the content we produce, please do consider joining our Patreon program, where you can support our ability to make great content. The link is in the comments below. And as always, if you like what you've seen here today, please share and like the post and add a comment or question. I read them all. And if you want to join the Grand Band of subscribers who receive alerts when we release new posts, do subscribe now by hitting that subscribe bell. And if you've already subscribed, many thanks. I really appreciate your support and participation. I'm Martin North, the Principal Analyst at Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you again next time.